Welcome to Crime Wire, a program dedicated to bringing attention to unsolved crimes and educating the public about various types of crimes and how to avoid becoming a victim. If you'd like to submit a case to Crime Wire or suggest a topic for a future show, please email us at thenewcrimewire@gmail.com. My name is Denny Griffin, and on today's show, my co-host Delilah Jones and I will discuss the 2006 disappearance and presumed death of Michelle Hutchings of Clinton, New York. The then 27-year-old was last seen on Bleecker Street in Utica, New York on July 30, 2006. Joining us to talk about the case is Oneida County, New York, Undersheriff Robert Swinskowski. Undersheriff, welcome back to Crime Wire.
How are you, Denny? Delilah, it's great to be back.
We're just happy to have you back again. You always bring us such good information, and you know, hopefully our listeners are thinking the same thing, and I'm sure they are.
I appreciate that.
Undersheriff, it's been just over 10 years since Michelle disappeared, apparently without a trace. I believe the case has been declared a homicide. Can you give our listeners some additional background and tell us the current status of the investigation?
Yep. You know, unfortunately, it's been 10 years. We just did some interviews, some other informational media outlets, Michelle's mother, myself. When our administration took over the sheriff's office in 2011, you know, the case was already 5 years old, 6 years old, going into that area. We discovered that probably today that they followed up on over 425 leads. That's how extensive the case was. So Michelle, unfortunately, she had some addiction problems, and she lived in a village in Clinton, New York. However, she spent a lot of time in the city of Utica. And when I say a lot of time, it was not uncommon to her to go days or weeks without coming home. Was something, you know, her family struggled with, and her mom struggled with to help her, you know, fight an addiction that she had. And she basically fell into associating with a lot of criminal element within the city of Utica.
Would it be safe to assume that the Bleecker Street area then is maybe, what would we call it, a crime-ridden or a high-crime area?
There's certain portions of it where she was, you know, many years ago, it was an extremely popular storefront area. Everything was in walking distance. The further into certain areas you go, the city has become a little run down, and yeah, you do have a lot of drug activity, prostitution. You know, there has been shootings in those areas and things like that. So, unfortunately, it has become a less desirable area of the city, and you know, as of late, the city itself has certainly been improving its atmosphere and environment, and the Utica Police is, you know, they do an outstanding job with what they have, and they certainly have a lot to work with. But yeah, I mean, if you look at the county of Oneida, there's major cities, Rome and Utica, you know, most of the drug activity and things like that come out of the city of Utica.
I noticed when I was doing a little research for today's program, is that in January 2007, there was the body of a woman named Jennifer Bennett, a 29-year-old Utica woman found in Deerfield.
Yes.
Suspicious death. And it said the Bennett woman and Michelle were associated with some of the same people. Is it possible then that those two deaths, again, I guess the body of Michelle hasn't been found yet, but she's presumed dead. Do you think there could be any connection between those two cases?
As it stands, I'll give you the fast-forward everything. The killer of Jennifer Bennett was found through DNA, and I'll give you that story. But, yes, Michelle and Jennifer ran in basically the same circles, knew the same thing. Jennifer was a prostitute. She was picked up by a man, and he eventually strangled her and killed her and dumped her body in the snow in a neighboring town the town of Deerfield were literally behind a fire department. And unfortunately, it was like kids that were sledding actually discovered the body. It went unsolved for a little while till that person ended up in our jail. And now that we do, and this is the whole reason behind DNA identification, they took his DNA. He was in for a petty charge. I want to say it was like an aggravated unlicensed operation charge of a vehicle. Took his DNA. Shortly before he was going to be released, we discovered there was a hit from the Jennifer Bennett case, and it ended up that he confessed to the murder of her, that he solicited Jennifer as a prostitute and, you know, brought her somewhere to have sex and ended up killing her. So certainly there was concern that there might have been similarities, and he was, you know, a suspect until obviously he was eliminated. Just given the surrounding circumstances of both cases,
he did not, you know, fit that the profile and the information that we had.
Let me ask you a question that I think I know the answer to, but I'm not sure. when you have a case such as Michelle's where there's no body found, it seems to me that drastically reduces or impedes investigation, because the body, if located, can be a wealth of information for investigators. When you don't have that body to work with and to examine and perhaps get DNA, like you mentioned in the Bennett situation, how tough does that make it to investigate a case when there's no remains found?
Well, as far as actually even declaring it officially a homicide, I mean, you know, you can't. And that's the tough
right.
part, and it's the frustrating part here. I mean, is there that, you know, 0.001% chance that, you know, Michelle, you know, took off to California and said, this is the only way I'm going to change my life, or is out there? Sure there is. I mean, from the information we have obtained, no, more than likely, you know, our understanding is, you know, she was killed somehow with some of the people that she was involved in, whether it was over, you know, money or drugs, or she was just a victim that fell prey to one of these people she associated with, you know, that still remains to be seen. But basically the word on the street and over those 425 leads that we've had, it surely indicates that it appears to be she's been murdered. And we've, you know, been out to New Jersey, we've been to Albany, we've been to, you know, different areas within the state, outside the state, you know, following up on, you know, some wild goose chase leads and some leads that, you know, basically brought us closer to the conclusion that, yeah, she probably was murdered. But you hit that on the head is, you know, we don't have anything to work with. Like in the Bennett case, we had a body, we had DNA, so it's just a matter of time to, you know, narrow down to, you know, potentially finding a suspect. Where this, you know, it's extremely frustrating because this is, I mean, the case is certainly at a point where, you know, my personal concern is for her family. You know, I mean, we'd love to have, you know, the fairy book tale that, you know, she went off somewhere and, you know, found herself and got better and, you know, she's still alive. But, you know, the reality is, you know, I'd love to give the family some type of closure in, you know, finding Michelle's body, finding her, and, you know, that's the first part. The second stage, of course, would be, you know, bringing her justice. But, I mean, as a parent myself, you know, I waited to, geez, if you had a choice and you couldn't find out who did it, but you could get that closure, you know, it's a tough choice to make. And you certainly, you know, they're entitled to both.
Now, if unidentified remains are at some point located, then they could be matched up. If it is, Michelle could be matched up with the DNA.
Yes, there are certainly means to match up if there's remains found, you know, whether it had been through DNA or dental records or other means. There certainly would be a way to do that, and that would be something that, you know, we would follow through on an investigation. And again, you know, this could be something that, you know, unidentified remains pop up in, you know, Pennsylvania. You know, we're always, you know, the case is considered open, and, you know, we actively take leads on it. We just recently followed up on one about 2 weeks ago, you know, with a person in a local jail claiming to know some information. You know, it didn't culminate to anything, but still, we consistently follow up on these leads.
Now, you mentioned going back to the Bennett case for a minute. This was the situation where you had someone in on a relatively minor charge, and yet because you're now doing DNA from your inmates, you were able to get this match and get the hit and a subsequent confession. How many facilities do you think? It's a tough question. I guess I'm talking nationwide. But do you think a lot of facilities now are into the DNA collection of new arrivals?
They've put it into New York State law. The DNA collection actually comes to people that come into our jail after they're arrested. So it's basically seen as along the same lines as fingerprinting at this point. So, you know, we're taking for certain level crimes and higher. To me, I mean, my personal opinion is, you know, just like fingerprinting, it should be used the same way. But they're collecting DNA and putting it in a database. I've had mine taken because, like, different police officers say you go to a burglary scene and you touch something. Well, they have to rule out your DNA, say, hey, yeah, Rob Swankowski was at that scene. We have his DNA on file. That's the one that showed up on this window because he looked in the window, put his hand there, or things like that. So to me, it's very useful. There's been some Supreme Court cases that have favored law enforcement. Some people believe it's intrusive. You know, I look at it like fingerprints. It's an identifying marker of each person. And, you know, if you don't do anything wrong, what is the concern about having DNA on file? You know, and we get people that, you know, they're introduced into the criminal justice system. They take it's a non-intrusive swab. It's just basically like putting a Q-tip in the inside of your cheek. They rub it and they collect DNA and they have that in a database. But, you know, we have a guy getting picked up today from our jail that his DNA was a match for a rape in the state of Ohio 20 years ago.
Wow.
So, you know, as we speak right now, this guy's getting picked up in my jail and getting shipped out to Ohio for a rape from 20 years ago. So, you know, I bring that up because to me there's still hope for this case, you know, and cases similar to it that you hear about, you know, and I can't appreciate you guys enough concentrating on cold cases because, you know, people always think about it being on the back burner. That's not necessarily true. A lot of these cases are at the forefront of people's minds every day because, you know, as police officers, we don't like for, you know, justice not to be served. We don't like to have an unfinished case or something that's unresolved in our business. It's just part of our personality. So, you know, it's very important that we address this. And there's someone out there, if not more than one person, that knows about this or has intimate details about this. And we just hope either through, you know, whether it's a guilty conscience or they feel compelled to finally do the right thing, or they're put in a precarious situation where, you know, it benefits them to give out that details. I'm really not concerned how they do it, but it would certainly, you know, at one time or another, we're hopeful that someone's in that situation where that information's enough information, I should say, is divulged to move the case that one step forward.
Well, I have to say, I think it's great that you're collecting DNA on arrest. I think, you know, remember, Denny, when we had Maggie Zingman on years ago, and she is still, to this day, she travels all around the country. Her daughter was murdered and still unsolved, and DNA holds the key, and they just have not been able to find a match. So she has traveled all over the country all these years to get agencies to do what you're doing. And, you know, I think if we think about the inconvenience to people, or we think it's something
intrusive.
Yes, intrusive, thank you. What about the victims? What do we...
Right.
You know, we have to hold the victims we have to do more. And if this is what we can do to keep that person from committing more crimes, and also give the victim some kind of peace of mind that they're off the streets and there's justice served, too bad. Too bad.
Sure. And, I mean, we look at it, you know, if you we do, it's a project called Safe Child run through the New York State Sheriff's Association. And we take a thumbprint and a photo of a child in case they go missing. That's, you know, just a benchmark piece as far as a resource or a focal point to say, hey, here's a picture and a thumbprint. But yet, if you said you were going to do that, say, hey, when everyone reached the age of 10 or at birth, we're just going to take a DNA swab and put it on file. You know, you've always got those people that want to be adversarial and say, oh, that's intrusive somehow. But why? You know what I'm saying? I mean, if that can help you find your kid, you wouldn't be objective to it. But yet, if it's going to convict you of a crime, you know, it's just funny how some people view different things. And to me, I mean, I'd be the first person in line, hey, here's my DNA, you know.
Exactly.
It's, just,
well,
it's a great tool.
I think we as a society have been, you know, we've just been almost brainwashed to believe that criminals have rights, which they do. I'm not saying they don't. As human beings, they have rights. However,
sure.
when their rights supersede the victim's rights, I think we have a problem.
Oh, absolutely. I totally agree with you. I totally agree.
Amen. Delilah, you'll have to may have to refresh my memory somewhat here, but Undersheriff, do you remember the Morgan Harrington case from a few years ago? The student that disappeared, I think she was a Virginia Tech student. She disappeared from a concert.
I don't recall
it. Okay, and they found her remains, I guess it was a few months later. And it was a cold case until I think it was 2015, I believe. Another girl went missing. And they found the suspect in that case because, to a great degree, because they had camera that, you know, they had security camera footage that showed the girl with the suspect. He subsequently was arrested and took a plea, you know, the death penalty off the table in return for a guilty plea. And when they did his DNA, they found that he had murdered Morgan Harrington as well. And Morgan's mother has been on a crusade. Her name is Jill Harrington, and her husband have been on a crusade getting legislation. They got legislation passed in Virginia recently also making it a requirement that DNA be collected from persons entering the penal system there, jails and prison. And she said, Jill Harrington said, that had this law been in effect at the time her daughter was murdered, that wouldn't have happened because they would have had this guy. He would have been locked up. He wouldn't have been free. So, you know, what you're saying about the Bennett case and the Harrington case and all this, I really am pleased to hear that some of these people are being caught and perhaps, you know, other lives are being saved because of that, because they're off the streets and they're not out there able to do any more damage.
Yeah, and those are the type of things, you know, you wonder, like Craig Ingersoll was the murderer of Jennifer Bennett. And he actually, when he went into state prison, he committed suicide. But again, his DNA is on file. Did he do this out of state? Or did he do this to other people that haven't been found? You know, that's the good thing is at least you'll know. You know, and,
yes.
And like you say, with the case of Morgan, I believe I was looking at that, and it was a Jesse Matthew was the
yes.
was the murderer, and he had a history of sexual assaults. So, you know, I mean, you know, like Delilah says, you know, you got to weigh that and say, listen, you've got yeah. Whether it's a sexual predator, a murderer, a kidnapper, you know, how do you weigh that against that being intrusive? I just, you know, to me it makes no sense. There's no reason not to have, you know, some type of database with DNA from people that are introduced into the criminal justice system at minimum. If not, you know, if you did it at birth, I don't know what the issue would be.
Absolutely, and like Delilah was saying, you know, the rights of the victims should not be superseded by the criminals or the suspects. And I don't want to get off on a tirade about this.
Sure.
I could very easily.
Oh, yeah.
But sometimes political correctness kind of runs amok, and you know, it's we're so concerned about somebody's feelings or this feeling of intrusiveness or whatever.
Sure.
That really doesn't hold water, but yet it's out there, and it really aggravates me.
And I have to give, you know, the Supreme Court credit, because it was Maryland versus King. Supreme Court basically said, you know, when officers make an arrest that's supported by probable cause to hold for a serious offense and bring the suspect to the station to be detained for custody, taking a cheek swab is part of a booking process, a legitimate booking process. It's not intrusive. You know, and that's a great decision, you know, at minimum, because it certainly supports the ability to not only collect identifying markers, but solve crimes down the road.
Absolutely.
You know,
and I think I'm sorry, Dee, go ahead.
I was just going to add this in there. This case, in looking over the links that you sent and reading the little bit, really, details that are out there, it really has a lot of similarities to cases in Wilmington, North Carolina. Actually, the same time frame, 2006-2007, Allison Jackson Foy and Angela Rothen, both, you know, Angela, I believe, was a working prostitute. Allison was not. But again, they were kind of not in the same circles, but knew some of the same people. And it's just amazing to me, the similarities. You might want to take a look.
Yeah, absolutely.
There is a suspect there, but he has not been... He has not been charged. So there, you know, these cases are still unsolved as well.
Yeah, and that's the frustration. I mean, you know, even having a legitimate suspect, you know, in any crime, and Denny, I'm sure you've got enough experience between what you've written and studied and talked about. You know, if someone keeps something to themselves, that's a smart person. I mean, at the end, you know, people want to look at criminals as they're not intelligent and they're, you know, they're just some, you know, lower level of people walking around. It's really not necessarily true. Some of these people are professionals at what they do, and they're very good at what they do. And in crime, and especially, you know, organized crime, you learn this, the less people that knew, the more they got away with. You know, if someone did something with one person as compared to six people, there was less chance they were going to get caught. Less people talked, and, you know, that's the thing. If someone exclusively has murdered Michelle, you know, it's going to be harder to, you know, pinpoint an investigation towards that one person with the lack of evidence, and like you pointed out, no body, as compared to if there are a number of people that are aware. You know, you hope someone's, again, putting it that situation where they're going to talk.
Yes. Yeah, sometimes ignorance is bliss, and if you can keep if you're the culprit and you can keep it to yourself, obviously you're going to be tougher. You know, I mean, the chances of detection are a lot less than somebody else turning you in.
Sure.
You know, speaking of DNA, there was, I guess, a relatively new technology out now. And what was it, the Parabon Nanolab program, where they can now take the DNA. They can do this in the case of unidentified remains, or through DNA to identify a suspect. What they can do in the case of in those cases, they can take their DNA and end up drawing a photo or a picture of what the person whose remains were found would have looked like in real life, and they can do age progression photographs, and they can also do it with DNA from a suspect, such as, you know, rape and murder type thing.
Right.
And they can actually prepare a photo of the possible suspect. And
I'm actually looking at it as you're describing it to me, and that's very interesting. And they call it a Parabon snapshot.
Snapshot. Yeah, and I when I heard Snapchat. About it, I couldn't believe it. But I, it seems to me that would be a great asset too if you could, you know the about what the suspect would have looked like and then age enhance it. And
absolutely, it's and not only I mean they're not only showing you what they create, but they actually have a section here they show actual suspects that were apprehended after as comparison to the image that they created, and they're pretty much right on.
Yeah, so I think it sounds like a great tool. And when we interviewed the director of the lab, and she obviously is very excited about it, but the way it works apparently is the for example, if a family, if the family of the victim of the deceased person wanted that done, they can't just go to Parabon because Parabon has to work with the law enforcement agency that's involved in the case. Because one thing is they generally have control of the DNA.
Sure.
And they have to get that. Although in cases, I didn't price these testifying. I'm assuming they're pretty pricey. But in cases where if the department doesn't have the resources to for something like that, as long as they're willing to provide the DNA, they could work out a deal with the family, if they have the resources, could reimburse or pay the fee, even
sure.
though they wouldn't be the client. The client would be the police agency. But
right.
I think as word about that gets out, too, that's going to be a great tool for law enforcement.
Yeah, I've never seen it. And I'll tell you, it looks like some amazing technology. Again, they're putting up the DNA extractions, and then their snapshot composites, and then they show the actual person they did it for after, and they're right on the descriptions and the physical features. So that's just, again, one more way how technology helps, and it shows the importance of DNA collection.
And I'm trying to think of this from the perspective of a family of a victim. And when it's been all these years and you kind of give up hope, and then when you hear like the case of your inmate that's being sent back to Ohio for a 20-year-old homicide, and the Bennett situation and the Morgan Harrington things, and then the NanoLab snapshot, when you hear all that stuff, I would think that would give you a little hope that maybe someday.
Absolutely. The other important part, Judy Seelman is Michelle's mother. You know, we've talked numerous times in the last 6 years since I've been up here as undersheriff, and I know she's had contact with our agency since this agency took over that case. You know, she's certainly a reminder, too, of why it's important, again, and especially if you're a parent. I mean, I don't think anyone can't relate to, you know, God, what is this? You may not be able to empathize with it, but you certainly can sympathize. Geez, what is this person going through? You know, to want that closure. And she's just, you know, she's one of those women that, you know, she doesn't give up, and I give her a lot of credit for not doing that. But, you know, she's certainly, you know, insistent on, you know, this moving forward, and it should.
And speaking of the tenacity, if you will, of Mrs. Seelman, it seems to me that sometimes over the years, Delilah, I think, will verify that we've talked to a lot of victims' families when we profiled cases, and we found they're at their relationship with the investigating agency isn't all that great. You know, and obviously we're getting one side of the story, you know, from the family side. But there are issues, and where you just said where you've kept in touch with Mrs. Seelman, that type of thing I think is great, because the family is – it's nice for them to know that somebody cares.
Sure.
That they haven't been thrown in file 13, so to speak.
Right.
And I think sometimes some of the cases we've had that had the detective or the handling officer or whatever maybe maintained contact once in a while, it could have ease the situation and the animosity that built up over a period of time. When you don't, when the family's phone calls aren't returned, and you feel like you're being tossed aside.
Oh, absolutely.
You know, and that,
This case is, and it's far from perfect for the family, and you know, Mrs. Seelman has had her, you know, disappointments. She's had her frustrations with the case. You know, we've shared them. When I came in to this position, you know, we sat down in my office together and you know, kind of cleared the air about some things. And you have an understanding because, you know, you worked in government, criminal justice system, you know, you wrote about it, you studied it. But, you know, people that are blind to it, they don't have an understanding of a lot of the roadblocks we have. They have to do with, you know, people's rights and so on, you know, procedural things, you know, if we want to search something about getting a warrant, you know, things like that. And, you know, their end goal is this lady wants her daughter back. And she doesn't care how you do it, you know. So that's where the frustration, and I'm sure that's common in a lot of cases. You know, that's what we have to deal with. You know, she had to deal with, you know, going to the Utica Police Department. And I'm not, you know, disparaging them by any means, but she went to the city of Utica. And the city of Utica basically said, listen, just because she hangs out down here all the time doesn't necessarily mean, you know, we're going to take a case when you're saying she's missing from your house in the village of Clinton. You know, he went to the state police and she didn't get a great response from them and it ended up with us. Well, you know, that was a 2-week period of investigation that was lost. You know,
yeah.
Our guys couldn't get that time back. They had to basically go backwards into, okay, collecting all what happened. But, you know, that was a tough part for her to go through. And was any evidence lost during that? Was the, you know how time frames work. I mean, you know, it's very frustrating on our end too. So we share some of the same frustrations. And then there's some things that we're not going to understand that she goes through and on the same thing that she's just not going to understand some of the things that we have to do or have to abide by when we're doing these things. And it certainly does make it frustrating. So, you know, I certainly don't want to sugarcoat any aspect of it. She has certainly been frustrated at times. But at the end of the day, I think she knows legitimately, you know, we are trying to do everything we can do. And the hard part is, you know, when more cases come in and different cases come in, we have to work on those cases as they come in. So, you know, people don't, maybe I'm using the wrong terminology. Does it get, you know, pushed aside or it's not the main focal point of the day? Yes, that's the truth on these cases. You know, in America, you know, out of every 3 homicides, the statistics are 2 go unsolved. And that's tough. That's a tough pill to swallow. But you know what? We don't put it in a filing cabinet, forget about it. We make sure we touch base on things. We follow up with leads. And again, now it's just, it's a waiting game. It's a, you know, something you depend on over time that someone's going to slip up. Someone's going to be compelled to say something or somehow evidence is going to surface. That's going to lead this case to closure.
Yes, it's really that never giving up, like in the part of Mrs. Seelman and others like her, to hang in there no matter what, and try to work with the police agency as much as possible to get a result. You know, whether it's finding the daughter in the case of Mrs. Seelman, or finding a suspect in other cases. You can't give up, and when we talk to the families, we always encourage them, you know, as tough as it is, sometimes as frustrating as it can be, you gotta stay with it, and it enhances the chances of getting a favorable resolution or the resolution to the case, so it's very important.
Absolutely.
And I give these parents and families all the credit in the world when they do have the strength and the internal fortitude to hang in there and try to see things through to the end. It's very, very important, and again, very important to be working with the right police agency that gives your case the attention it can. Obviously,
sure.
Like you say, you have a lot of cases to work on, and you know, you can't take one necessarily and prioritize it over the others. You got to work them all. But, you know, when you get good, dedicated officers, that makes a big difference, too.
Yeah, Absolutely. And these guys that work in our criminal investigations unit, they take a lot of pride in what they do, you know, and certainly they don't forget an unsolved case. You know, to our recollection and what we could research in this agency, we haven't had an unsolved homicide. You know, we certainly don't want to start that practice, but, you know, the reality is this is a tough case. You know, it's a tough case. And we certainly will persevere. If I could just mention, too, I mean, if there is anyone that had any information, you know, we take any leads. We keep as much confidential as we need to, and we can be reached at 315-765-2244. And referring to case 0611057, or simply just to talk about Michelle Hutchings.
Great. Hopefully, we would be able to come up with a lead or two when the word gets out there and recirculates, because any of the publicity probably from 2006 and 7 is lost now, and maybe a little shot in the arm can help.
Sure. And there's an active Facebook page. If you just search on Facebook, Michelle Hutchings, you'll see that. I believe her family maintains an active Facebook page, just, giving little updates and little reminders, that the case is still open and that there's someone out there, responsible for her disappearance and possibly her death.
Delilah, the case like this, would that be anything that would be a Q-type case, or wouldn't that meet the criteria for Q? Did I lose Delilah? The Q is the Missing Persons organization. It's Minds of Missing Persons. And I, sometimes the people they look for end up as deceased. But they have it's a national organization. Delilah is the coordinator in South Carolina.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah, so I'm just thinking that's a possible resource for a case like this, as soon as we can get
her back. So now is that
back,
the Q, C-U-E-Q?
Yes, C-U-E.
Yeah, great.
And it's, they do missing persons work, and like I say, they don't find all of them, and sometimes it ends up badly. But badly, is that a Donald Trump word? They don't end up well.
Yeah, I think at the end of the day, and from what I've seen in my experience, the parents get to the point where it's just closure. They really, if that's all they get, they're out of the two things, that's what they'd want, and I'm certainly sure, everyone wants justice and they want to know who's responsible, but I think in my experience anyways, it becomes something that's secondary. The first thing is they just want to know where their child is, and I can certainly understand that.
Exactly. And even just getting a chance to talk about it sometimes, I know that some of the families, or most of the families we've had on, so much appreciate the opportunity to talk about their loved one. And, in addition to any the potential leads the programs might develop, they just appreciate being able to talk about their child or their brother or whoever the victim was.
Yeah,
absolutely. Am I on air, Danny?
You are on air.
I am. I must have had a button pushed. But I just want to add to what you so glowingly said, that yes, we do take cases like this. Any missing person case can be registered with Q, and their website is ncmissingpersons.org. And
I'm on it right now.
Good. To elaborate also what you said, a lot of times it is nice to have family members on a show like this, because they can personalize this case better than anybody can. I mean, all of us can give out the data on the case, but they really bring it home that this is a personal issue for them, and it gives that person that's missing a voice that they don't have.
And I totally agree with you. And that's some of the frustrations we face when people start talking about the circumstances, whether it was Jennifer or Michelle. oh, there's, you know, the people could have been involved in prostitution, there was drug addictions, they were running with bad crowds. I get that, you know, and that's unfortunate, and to some extent it complicates things, but at the end of the day, the girl was someone's child, you know, and no one deserves for that to happen. Everyone has struggles in their life. They go through different things. They're accountable for their actions. But again, it doesn't make it any less, or that we need to put any less effort, or that this person deserves somehow what they got. That's not the case. You know, this girl didn't deserve to be abducted. This girl doesn't deserve to be killed because of the lifestyle she led. So, you know, I think people certainly need to get over that, where there's, you know, less attention given to certain people in certain circumstances, and really focus on there's a heinous crime committed here and it needs to be solved.
Absolutely, because if that person that perpetrated this crime is still out there, it could be your kid next.
Certainly. And you know that's human nature. I mean, when people get away with things, you know, someone steals a toothbrush and then they steal, you know, a cassette tape, and I'm kind of dating myself here, and then they, you know, they move on and they move up the ladder, and they, you know, I mean, it's the more they get away with, it is. You know, when you're taking a human life or abducting someone or abusing someone, typically that's a behavior that you're not afraid to do again when you get away with it.
Yeah, I think you're right. You get away with the little thing, and then you escalate, you go up the ladder, and pretty soon you're into a lot more serious stuff.
Sure.
And it's all about getting away. You know, and I don't want to get into a debate on the criminal justice system, but sometimes when you read or hear these stories about judges who give rapists, you know, 6-month sentences. And I mean, these kind of things, you're thinking, what kind of message is that to send if you're trying to deter criminal activity? And I'm not against giving people breaks if they really deserve it. I'm, you know, and I understand that the courts are backed up, but if you can get a plea bargain and all that kind of stuff, I understand that. But I think they can go to the extreme with it too. And then, you know, it just doesn't, I don't think it serves justice. I don't think it does anything to deter crime when you.
Yeah, I agree. I do agree.
Yeah. And it's frustrating, I think, from everybody's side, the public, the family, and law enforcement. I think that's a no-win when the court system, you know, comes up with some of those case resolutions.
Yeah. It's certainly frustrating. And, you know, even being in the criminal justice system for 24 years, you know, I look at the sentencing, you know, guidelines for certain crimes, and I, you know, you shake your head. You like you said, how can a child that's victimized in a sexual assault, you know, how could their perpetrator get less time than someone convicted of, you know, their second DWI? And you just,
yeah,
you know, some of those things I don't understand.
And probably never will, I guess.
No.
I can't imagine them ever making sense.
No. You know,
what do you think about that, Delilah?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, our system is just a little bit twisted right now.
Yeah.
Yes. That's a good
way. Well, you know, you try to tell on that side, you know, we share those, like our investigators, you know, gee, you know, I'm glad they follow through on their cases, and I try to tell them, listen, you know, you may not be happy with an outcome. Someone may plea, you know, something may not go your way. Just understand that you did the best you can do, you know, in playing your part in bringing a person to justice. You know, and sometimes I hate to say it so simply, you know, it is what it is, you know, on that end, but it is what you make it. You know, if your investigation is good, you've done a good job, you know, these guys should be proud of what they do, and you know, there's different factions in the criminal justice system that, you know, some need to be improved upon, and, you know, some we have to just deal with, you know, what's out there right now to work with.
Yes. We're just about out of time here. Undersheriff, before we close out, could you give that phone number one more time, please?
Sure. 765-2244. And again, if just mention anything with Michelle Hutchins, and that's area code 315-765-2244. And again, we're taking active leads, and you know, information remains confidential if need be. And again, you know, we're just hoping that, you know, someone who has any information can help bring closure, certainly to this family and to this case.
Okay, and on that note, we will wrap it up. And thank you so much, Undersheriff, for being with us again. And hopefully we can get a little nudge going here and develop something that will be positive for the advancement of the case. And also, thanks very much to our listeners. Until next time, stay safe.
Thank you very much.
Bye-bye.
Take care.
Nothing beats the versatility of a 90s-era hatchback. You want trunk space? The whole thing is trunk space, giving you the ability to haul canoe-sized payloads with little more than a trusty old bungee cord holding down the hatch. And with over 400,000 parts and a little Napa know-how, you can keep your small utility vehicle running longer, stronger. Because it's not quirky, it's ahead of its time. That's Napa know-how.
Napa know-how.